Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I'm not going to waste my time on a virtual debate. That's not what debating's all about.
So, no more presidential debates then? The White House COVID outbreak reportedly is wider than first known. I asked veteran Washington correspondents Susan Glasser and Peter Baker whether things are spiraling out of control. Authors of the new book profiling leadership and the Republican Party. Plus,
we're very aware, and I think that's the important thing out of all of this, is a level of awareness.
Designer and environmental activist Stella McCartney talks about her new COVID manifesto. Then, our Michelle Martin speaks to Reverend Samuel Rodriguez about the evangelical vote in this high-stakes election.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, and fasten your seatbelts because it's going to be a bumpy ride all these last few weeks to the election. Today, President Trump said that he would not take part in any virtual debates. Then he said he would do it in person, but later. The Biden campaign has rejected that. Meantime, the White House COVID hotspot gets even hotter. At least one military aide who carries around the nuclear football, that's the briefcase with the nuclear codes, has been infected with the disease. In addition, President Trump is calling for his army of, quote, polite poll watchers to monitor the vote on November 3rd. And it doesn't stop there. The latest is that the FBI has foiled a plot to kidnap the Democratic governor of Michigan, who is a frequent target of President Trump. And last but not least, some are raising serious concerns about the president's erratic mood and behavior since he contracted COVID and since he's been taking a cocktail of drugs. How are we meant to process all of this? My first guests tonight are amongst the most experienced Washington watchers. They are the New Yorker journalist Susan Glasser and the New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. And their new book, The Man Who Ran Washington, about the former Republican Secretary of State James Baker, may help us figure some of this out. So, welcome to both of you to this program. I mean, seriously, how are we meant to process all of this? That list that I just read, I mean, you cannot make it up, and it all happened within the space of a few hours. Peter, let me ask you, what is going on inside the White House? You're a White House correspondent.
Yeah, it's a place that's shell-shocked right now. It's a place that doesn't understand what to do. The aides are either sick themselves, trying to get tested, staying home, or trying to figure out what to do and get information. They're very frustrated. They haven't, in fact, been given information about their own safety. They're very frustrated about the political situation. They don't know what to do with the president, who won't stay isolated in the residence as he has been advised to do. And I think that it's a place that feels very unhinged at the moment. It's very, very, it's become the number one coronavirus hotspot in all of Washington, D.C. And so you've got a president who's lashing out like a caged lion because he's frustrated and looking at polls that are very, very bad for him right now.
And as you mentioned, a lot of the senior tier is infected, including his campaign manager. Hence this hullabaloo about whether he will actually agree to a debate or not by his own conditions. Biden says he won't agree to what President Trump is putting forward. Susan, how does this look? If there's no more debating, is that a problem?
Well, look, Trump is the one who needs to somehow change the dynamic in the campaign. So, you know, you would think that normally someone who is behind would want to debate and, in fact, would seek every effort to try to get himself in front of the people and change the dynamic, except, of course, that Trump's performance in the first debate was such a debacle. And, you know, I think it will probably go down in history as the worst presidential debate in U.S. history. And so, in a way, it might have seemed like a face-saving way out, especially, Christian, because the debate that was supposed to take place next week was a debate, a town hall style debate in which regular Americans were going to ask questions. And that is not, to say the least, a format that favors President Trump. He did one recently on ABC that was really a disaster for him. He's not used to facing skeptical audiences outside of his sort of Fox News bubble and, you know, rallies of adoring fans. So, you know, interestingly, you know, he may have reckoned that it benefited him not to have that second debate. But, you know, he's behind in the polls, and it does appear that Biden's lead, which was already substantial, is widening a bit since that disastrous debate performance last week.
Okay, so you talked about Fox News. He also told Fox News that Kamala Harris, Senator Harris, who's Vice President Biden's vice presidential running mate, had her debate with Mike Pence, the vice president, last night. We understand it is one of the biggest audiences ever for a vice presidential debate. The numbers are coming in, and they way outnumber those who watched the vice presidential debate in 2016. I mean, never has it been more important, this notion of being a heartbeat away from the presidency, whether we're talking about a COVID-infected President Trump or, you know, an elderly, but not COVID-infected, we don't think, Joe Biden. Tell me a little bit, you know, Peter, how important you think this debate was.
Well, I think as a matter of substance, it was very important because for the reasons you just said. One of these two people has a much better than average chance of becoming president someday, and in the not-too-distant future, even potentially. These are the two oldest people we've ever had running for president against each other. Each of them will outpace Reagan, who was the previous oldest president we've had, if he's elected. Joe Biden would be 82 in his fourth year if he's elected, and Donald Trump, as you point out, is you know, just getting out of the hospital with a deadly disease. So there's a lot of attention and a lot of importance placed on the number twos. In terms of changing the race, I don't think the debate changed anybody's minds, or at least not a lot anyway. I think it probably did it. It was important for Kamala Harris, who's never been a nationwide elected official before, the only one of the four appearing these last 2 weeks who hasn't been, to show that she is a credible and plausible, not only vice president, but potential president. And I think that she probably did that last night.
So she's the first African-American woman to a vice presidential candidate, woman to be on that stage in that kind of, you know, position. And Mike Pence himself paid tribute last night to the historic nature of her candidacy, only for the president today to revert to his, you know, somewhat, some would say, misogynistic terms that he uses against women. It used to be nasty. Now he calls her a communist and a monster. Susan, as a woman, you don't have to be a woman to comment on this, of course, but how do you think that would go down at this moment, those kinds of words about somebody like Senator Harris?
You know, Christian, that's one thing that never ceases to amaze me about the Trump campaign this year, is that facing an enormous deficit in the polls with women, in particular college-educated suburban women, you know, we're looking at the biggest gender gap potentially in American history, even more so than when Hillary Clinton ran against Donald Trump. And yet, you know, Trump seems to go out of his way to alienate these women voters that Republicans need in order to stave off a debacle. And by the way, I actually thought Mike Pence was also, you know, very patronizing to Kamala Harris last night. He interrupted her repeatedly. In fact, there was a female moderator, Susan Page. He wouldn't listen to either one of them in a way that, I don't know about you, but I've been in that situation a million times before. And I don't think there's a lot of women watching that who didn't feel the painful recognition of, you know, here's a patronizing man who just won't shut up even when it's not his turn. And then you have Donald Trump, who, of course, not calls names of everyone, men and women, but he seems to have a special animus toward women in public life. Look at how he's demeaned Nancy Pelosi from the beginning of her speakership. And, you know, to call Kamala Harris a monster, I mean, really? Really?
It was extraordinary. Can I just ask you, Peter? I mean, you said people are very nervous inside the White House. Look, we raised this idea that potentially there may be some, I don't know, mood altering or euphoria one moment and something else the next. These are the side effects of some of these drugs that we're told that he's been taking. We don't get a straight answer from his doctor as to exactly how he is and when he last tested negative. How worried, or is this just media chatter? Is anybody really worried about his state of mind?
Well, I think they're wondering. I think they are, because look, the particular mix of different medications that they have given him for the COVID-19 hasn't been done so many times that they have a lot of experience with it. We don't know how a lot of these drugs interact with each other. And then the steroids themselves are known to create a feeling of euphoria and to mask any pain or discomfort, and in some cases even have even bigger effects on a person's state of mind. We don't know that that's what's happening here, but of course people in the White House are wondering themselves about it. Now, the president said this morning that he's no longer taking the other medication. He's only still on the steroids, but the steroids by themselves would be enough to raise questions. And we don't have the answers. You're right. We haven't seen the doctor now in several days, and he hasn't been particularly forthcoming even when we did see him.
Let's just talk a little bit about your book, which has been out for a bit now, getting very good reviews. It's called The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James Baker III. Well, of course, many people remember that he served presidents from Reagan on down. He was Secretary of State. He was Secretary of the Treasury. He was a chief of staff. What do you think, how would he handle the multiple crises that are going on right now? And remember, of course, he also was the lawyer for the Bush, W. Bush, who essentially won the Supreme Court vote for W. Bush after the 2000 election, and Bush then became president. What kind of leadership do you think there might be if there was so-called an adult in the room right now?
Well, look, clearly it's now seems that no one can be the adult in the room with Donald Trump. So many have cycled in and out. So perhaps even Jim Baker could not run that White House. I suspect that is the case. But I will say this, he was famous for making deals at a time when it was still possible to do so in American politics. And that required working with Democrats across the aisle. It required working with Soviets to help manage the end of the Cold War. And, you know, one thing that Baker was a master at was sitting down with those who might potentially be adversaries and finding a way towards a solution that everyone could agree upon. I mean, you know, he famously was even able to negotiate Hafez al-Assad, in Syria to entice him to participate in the Madrid Peace Conference. And, you know, that's not easy. If you can negotiate with, Hafez Assad, you can negotiate with Democrats on Capitol Hill. And right now, look at how Democrats and Republicans and Trump have failed to produce any COVID relief package for the American people since April, despite millions of being out of work, companies going bust, Legion, state and local government suffering. And, you know, I do believe that were Jim Baker in a position of power right now, that just absolutely would not have happened. It's like Washington has lost the habit and the ability and the incentive to actually do something once in power. It's not power for its own sake right now, it often seems to be. And he taught us, I think, that, you know, you can really, you should be in government to get something done.
Yeah, power. You do mention the word power a lot, and I think he is somebody who recognized power and how he would quite like to have it, particularly for his own party. Hence, the importance of his role during the 2000 election debacle afterwards. What about Pence refusing to answer the moderator last night about whether they would respect the integrity of the election? Peter, how do you... Well, I mean, obviously, it's a big gap not to answer that question, but what do you think is going to happen on November 3rd?
Well...
Tell me.
No,
I don't mean who's going to win. I mean, if it's contested as it was in 2000.
Yeah. It's very possible, obviously, that we could have not only just Florida all over again, we could have Florida on steroids. And not just because we might have challenges in one state or two or three or more, but because you have a president who's made very clear that he doesn't even believe in the system, that he's tearing down the credibility of the very fabric of the system itself. He says the whole thing is rigged, the whole thing is corrupt. And basically, he's made clear that any result other than a victory for him is going to be something he's going to question. And you wonder whether or not, if it went all the way up to the Supreme Court the way it did in 2000, whether he would accept the ruling that went against him, because it's not really clear that he would. Whatever you say about Florida, as tough as it was and as disappointing as it was to some people, in that moment you had Jim Baker, Al Gore, George W. Bush, people who had fundamental respect for the system. And when the fight was over, they all basically said, okay, it's now over. We accept the outcome. We're going to move on.
And of course, if this new SCOTUS appointee, if it actually does go through and everything happens as the Trump administration wants it to happen, there will be a heavy balance in favor of the conservative viewpoint. Let me ask you this as well. You see how many Republicans, whether they're former military, former diplomatic, national security, even the Republican chairman of the RNC, the former Michael Steele, who came out and endorsed the Democrat, Joe Biden, have said, you know, We can't do Trump this year. We might like a tax cut. We might like what he does about the Supreme Court, but we can't. What did James Baker say to you about that? Is he going to vote for Trump?
You know, Christian, you would think that he would be almost a natural never Trumper, you know, but we've talked with him over the last 5 years. We've been working on this book as Trump has risen and, you know, asked him that question over and over again. And, you know, he's been tortured about Trump, I think, in a way that helps you to understand why it is that even after everything, you may well see 41, 45% of the American people still voting for Donald Trump. You know, Baker is very clear that he thought Trump was nuts. That's a word he used. Crazy. That's a word he used. Just yesterday, we were at appearance with him, and he went on about how America's alliances in the world are in a disastrous state because of Trump. And yet, he voted very reluctantly for Trump in 2016, he told us. And he at one point told us he might vote for Joe Biden this year. But I think he's made it pretty clear at this point that he sees his Republican identity and the conservative priorities of, you know, more judgeships and the like as outweighing his personal qualms about Trump. It's a little bit hard to square with the man and his record, but I think it's very telling, actually, about the state of the modern GOP.
Let's just get back to the state of the current election and the issues. Last night, the whole idea of healthcare, obviously, in this COVID pandemic was brought up. And next week, the Supreme Court could make another ruling on the Affordable Care Act. This is a couple of, you know, interventions by both Pence and Harris. Let's just listen.
If you have a pre-existing condition, heart disease, diabetes, breast cancer, they're coming for you. If you love someone who has a pre-existing condition,
they're coming for you.
If you are under the age of 26 on your parents' coverage, they're coming for you.
Obamacare was a disaster. The American people remember it well. And President Trump and I have a plan to improve health care and to protect pre-existing conditions for every American.
What should, Peter, American voters listening to that take away from that? Because certainly in 2018, the worry about taking away Obamacare was one of the things that propelled the blue wave in Congress.
That's true. It was a very useful issue for the Democrats 2 years ago, and it may be again this fall. I mean, Democrats are trying to make a lot out of the Supreme Court case to say, look, this is on the ballot as well, that basically this is at stake and they could take away your health care. Some of the legal experts we've talked to say that may be overstating what the impact of that case might be or overstating the possibility that they would take such drastic action. But even if not the case, you know, Vice President Pence says we've got a plan, and they don't. They haven't produced that plan. They've been asked, and they've never actually produced before. They have had a promise of not eliminating pre-existing conditions, but they haven't produced a plan for how that would work. And that's a pretty important distinction 4 years into the administration, not to actually tell us how they plan to do it.
And finally, let me ask you, maybe everybody can see that you're sitting really closely together. There's no social distancing. There's no masks. Well, you're married. You're in your own bubble and you've written this book together. How was writing this book together?
Well, the good news, Christian, is that we're still on speaking terms. So that, you know, that is good. You know, luckily, we have done this before. We wrote our book about Russia and Vladimir Putin's rise. And actually, that was the very same day that our son arrived early. So that was actually much harder. this was a long time in the making, but, you know, a great project to do together.
Peter Baker, Susan Glasser, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And now, The UK and much of Europe are in the grip of the second COVID wave, and the US has never even got out of the first. As governments struggle with testing and tracing, a vaccine is still the holy grail. Here in Britain, the government is the first in the world to consider allowing a unique vaccine trial where volunteers are deliberately exposed to coronavirus. And thousands of them say they are ready to take part. Many of these would-be volunteers are young people who, of course, are often blamed for the resurgence of the virus right now. Correspondent Phil Black speaks to some of those who are eager to participate.
Like so many, Estefania Hidalgo has quietly endured the challenge, the inconvenience of living through a pandemic. But she wanted to do more.
This was a way for me to take back control of the situation, to feel like I was in a more or in a less hopeless place, in a less hopeless world, and be like, okay, I can do this to make it better. I chose not to be in fear.
So she volunteered to be deliberately infected with the coronavirus.
I was shaking, but then I just, without knowing, I just typed my name in and was like, let's go for it.
Shaking.
I want to be part of it. Yeah, because it can be scary, right? Like, you're going to be potentially exposed to the virus.
Alistair Fraser-Urquhart is also very keen to be infected. He helps with running the recruitment campaign Estefania signed up to. One day sooner, finds volunteers, so far tens of thousands around the world, and has been lobbying the UK government to make use of them through potentially risky research.
I wake up thinking about challenge trials, and I go back to bed thinking about challenge trials.
Challenge trials involve giving young, healthy people a potential vaccine, like this one developed by London's Imperial College, then later testing it by deliberately dosing them with the virus. Proponents say it's faster than waiting for test subjects to be exposed to a specific virus in the real world. With numerous COVID-19 vaccines being developed, some scientists think challenge trials could help identify the best of them sooner.
By taking that small risk on myself, I can, you know, potentially protect thousands of other people from, you know, having to be infected without consenting to it.
Critics say challenge trials have limited use because the young, healthy people who take part don't represent the broader population. They have been used against other viruses. This is corporate video from a London facility that recruits, exposes, and strictly quarantines people to test influenza vaccines. But there are always risks, especially with a new virus that's already killed more than 1 million people. And epidemiologists say it's likely some volunteers would be needed for a control group to make sure the virus dose can cause disease. It means they'd be exposed to the coronavirus without receiving a vaccine. The real potential for doing harm to volunteers would be closely scrutinized by regulators.
A challenge trial would have to make the cogent argument that the benefits to society greatly outweighed the risk, and that evidence or those data could not be achieved in a simpler, safer way.
Test subjects in challenge trials are compensated financially, but Alistair's father knows that's not motivating his son. A crucial ingredient for any COVID-19 challenge trial will be the determined idealism of its young volunteers.
We'll be watching that. And the pandemic and the global uprising for racial justice are pushing many businesses around the world to rethink sustainability and social responsibility. But my next guest has made this part of her brand's DNA from the start. Fashion designer Stella McCartney is out today with a new spring-summer collection and a new manifesto called A to Z. She tells me that she came up with this roadmap for her future while forced to hit the pause button during lockdown. I went to see her in her studio here in London to find out what's changed. Stella McCartney, welcome back to the program. So the last time we spoke obviously was before COVID. You have had a moment of pause, right? What have you been doing through the lockdown? How has it affected your work?
Well, I mean, I think like everyone, I found myself asking sort of bigger questions, really, of what I do and why I do it, why do you come to Stella McCartney if you can buy anything from any brand in the world? And why would you come and work here? And I found what I was really proud of is that I believe so deeply in what we do here and how we have a completely new approach to the business of fashion. And I think coming back to fashion as a consumer, if you can come back with a more conscious level of consumption, lots of C's, and that's what kind of hit me really. You know, we focused a lot on the collection, on how we could reduce what we produced, how we could do more with less, and just, you know, really challenge ourselves to be the best sustainable fashion house on earth.
So sustainability is your thing, and this is where you've pioneered, I think, the fashion industry. Just want to ask you, just out of interest, have you noticed people buying different things during lockdown? I mean, are people buying more loungewear other than more sort of going out wear?
Well, I mean, you know, the ball gowns aren't exactly rushing out of the stores. Yeah, there's been a big difference in the way people buy. You know, one of the biggest things that we do that people maybe don't even understand, or we assume people understand, is we're a vegan brand. And, you know, that probably has the most positive footprint for us as a house, that we're not sort of buying into animal agriculture. And what is a vegan? You know, I don't think a lot of people know. So I think
so your definition of a vegan then, as it applies to fashion?
Yeah, is no animal products. All of our accessories, for example, are using vegan glues as opposed to animal glues, which are boiled down bones, which is not that sexy. So, and obviously faux leathers, faux furs, and just sort of talking about what we do and trying to also keep it sexy and fun and like not telling people off and just giving it an alternative, you know, creating a solution that doesn't in any way sacrifice what you want from fashion.
Do you find that you're not pushing on such an uphill boulder?
I think so. I think for a few years now, I've noticed that the fashion industry, which has normally been very fickle and weirdly, it takes longer sometimes to see the fashion in food, the fashion in lifestyle. People's choices have slowly been coming to this sort of way of thinking. And, you know, I think it's because the next generation of people are afraid for their future and they're having to buy things and live their lives in a different way and be more conscious. So it's finally come to the door of fashion. And yeah, I think I'm less of a sort of eco weirdo in the room now. I think I can have these conversations with my, you know, with my fellow designers and people in the industry, and it's something that is welcomed.
And we've spoken before, I mean, your mother was considered even more of an eco weirdo than you were, because she was like the first just about in public life to talk about vegetarianism and the kind of things that you're pursuing now. But that, of course, brings me to one thing that you have been working on, an alphabet, a new Stella McCartney alphabet. What is that all about? It's the A to Z of?
It's the A to Z, really, of the house. You know, I had a couple of weeks in the COVID lockdown period where I, like I said before, I was reflecting on what we do here at Stella and why people come to us. And I kind of woke up, you know, in a fairly sleepless night. So I sort of wrote a manifesto. So it's an A to Z or an A to Z, however you want to pronounce it, of words that really put into place the belief system here at Stella.
So I'm going to take A first, A for accountability.
Yeah.
Tell me about that, because you've picked a fairly new young artist. Mm-hmm. He's a Black American artist. So the accountability is what?
You know, you can translate it however you want to translate it. You know, for me to be accountable is to be present in the impact that I have, both in my interactions with people, in my actions, in with myself, you know, how I am as a human being inhabiting this planet with fellow creatures. So I think the great thing about the alphabet is that you can make it what it is to you, and you can personalize it. It's not me telling you how to be. It's, I guess, asking yourself questions and wondering if you're fully being accountable and if you want to, you know, be a better citizen.
So this artist is Rashid Johnson, who did the A.
Yeah.
And particularly in the fashion industry, I mean, there haven't historically been that many Black models, Black catwalk models, Black, you know, front covers of magazines. Do you agree? Do you think fashion has taken its eye off historically the racial justice and the representation ball?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything has, everyone has. That's why we're having this conversation. It's not just fashion, it's broadcasting, it's film, it's literature, it's the arts, it's, you know, politics, it's everything.
One of the other artists that you have in your manifesto is Olafur Eliasson. He's famous for his climate-related work and his interactive work.
Well, he took O because Olaf obviously is for O. I think a lot of the artists, we sort of encouraged. Jeff Koons took K for kindness, and you know, we sort of encouraged them to take the, something that came also with their name. But Olaf is an amazing artist. I'm a huge fan of his work, and it's very sort of, it makes perfect sense for him because he's a very environmental artist, I would say, very aware of Mother Earth and nature and the change that we all need to make to protect her. And so he did a beautiful piece of work, which was layering all of these sort of transparent colors and this beautiful O that came from that. And it's funny because the circle is very strong at Stella McCartney. It's something that we use in our Falabella bag as one of the charms. And it, our brand name is even made up of dots. And for me, it's the circular economy of how we work as well. And, you know, really sort of being aware of waste and the level of waste in the fashion industry. The thing is, what happens in luxury fashion, which I think is shocking that it's, I'm even still saying this, is a lot of the houses, we all design our own individual prints. And because of that, houses are reluctant to then sell them on, or if there's a, you know, some excess after a production run or something, and they don't tend to give them away or sell them, for example. And so instead they bury them or they burn them. And I've never been able to get my head around that level of waste. I find it just really excessive and vulgar and just wrong. So we keep all ours, but it means that then we're sort of stockpiling all of these fabrics season after season. So what we've tended to do now for many collections is reuse them. And so it's a form of sort of recycling, and it's a circular economy in the sense that it's less linear. You're not sourcing and then sort of finishing, you're sourcing and continuing. So we made a dress recently that was zero waste for our spring collection, and it's just made of strips and strips of all of our prints. And we sort of figured out it was over 20 seasons of different prints in this zero waste garment. And this idea that in a sense we created limited edition pieces, because once they ran out, the fabric ran out,
that
it ran
it.
Out, you know, and that's not something that people want to do in my industry because they just want to sell more and more and more.
Do you think fast fashion is getting the message, or is it still a big outlier when it comes to waste, when it comes to disposing, and when it comes to the fabrics, when it comes to paying people fairly?
Every single second a truckload of fashion is burnt or buried. Things, I think it's under 1% is recycled. It means there's 99% of waste being generated. Things are worn only up to three times, if you're lucky, before they're just disposed of. And that level of kind of disregard, I think, is something that we all need to be responsible for. But, you know, it's easy for me to say, because, you know, I'm not a cheap brand. And so I do encourage recycle clothing, vintage clothing, renting clothing. There's so many different ways.
Well, I was going to ask you, yeah, because what do you say to people who buy a really expensive Stella McCartney and don't want to just wear it once?
I say wear it as many times as you want to. But I think that's, for us, T in the alphabet, for example, is by William Eggleston, and it's timeless. As a designer, for me, one of the things that all of us can do is design in a timeless manner, because trends are part of the mm-hmm. kind of problem. And here at Stella, it's critical for me that, you know, you're wearing what I'm wearing. I want to wear it over and over and over again, and I want to have it well enough made that I can do that. You know, I want to be able to make money off it when I'm done with it. I want it to go up in value. And looking, we work, for example, with a company called Econeal, and they take waste from fishing nets or from old fabrics and recycle it into a nylon thread. And we've basically contributed to tons and tons and tons of fabric not being made, which is great. You know, that I love that.
I want to go back to the alphabet and L. I mean, obviously, your mother is so much part of your whole ethos, your ethic, your style.
And my dad too.
Of course your dad. I'm going to ask a question about your dad later.
It's okay, Dad.
L, letter L in your alphabet is for your mum.
It's for Linda. It's also sort of Linda and stroke love, because I think that for us at Stella, love is important. You know, we put so much love into everything that we do. And there you go. All you need is love. There you go. I'll do it for you.
And you love your dad. And I'm going to try to insert a dad question. And this is really off a radio interview I just heard. Your father, Paul McCartney, has been doing a historical review or something about his partner, John Lennon. And he spoke to the two sons, Sean and Julian Lennon. And do you know anything about it?
No, but that is a really important thing, I would say, for them to do. It's a healing process as well for all of them.
For
you know,
all of
I
them.
Encourage that relationship very much, and that's lovely to hear. I mean, I know that Sean was just texting me today actually saying that it's the the celebration of John's life coming up with his birthday. So it maybe has something to do with that. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, all of those, you know, everyone needs to sort of reach out at a time like this.
Do you remember John Lennon?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, yeah. I was lucky enough to spend time with him as a child. Yeah, I do very much. Yeah.
Was he like an uncle?
I would say he was like an uncle from, you know, in a very different way. We're a really weird set, the Beatles kids, and it's a family. It's very much an extension of a family. So, you know, all of the kids, we're like, God, we're the only ones that get it. We're always like, God, my God, how weird is this? And we'll have a conversation, like, you know, so, yeah, we're definitely a big family.
That's amazing. One other letter that I wanted to focus on, because she's such an amazing artist and photographer, Cindy Sherman, does E.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that, because we've got the picture.
It's E for effortless, and I think that's really important. You know, one of the reasons I started wanting to be a fashion designer at the age of sort of 9 was because I believe very much in the psychological connection between what you wear and it reflecting who you are and how you feel. And as a woman designer, I want to kind of encourage us women to feel great about ourselves. And so Cindy is a dear friend. She was kind enough to do E for effortless. She's a tree and she's sort of embracing, you know, whatever she's embracing. But I think humor, again, we have H for humor by an artist called Alex Israel in the alphabet, an LA-based artist. And he took the H from the Hollywood sign and took it off, and it's crashing into a car. And humor is important because at the end of the day, these are heavy subject matters that we're covering at Stella. And I don't want to feel, you know, like I'm lecturing people. I don't want people to feel like I'm, you know, making them feel bad or that I'm just kind of greenwashing or using this for marketing. Like, this is what we really do here. And we want to be sort of information driven and solution driven with a smile. It's like, you know, let's have some fun. It's fashion after all.
Stella McCartney, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And tomorrow would have been John Lennon's 80th birthday. Now, 26 days to go to the US election, and both candidates are after, of course, every last vote. A Pew Research Center poll found at least 82% of white evangelicals are preparing to vote again for President Trump, which is his famous base, of course. But he also has growing support amongst non-white evangelicals. Pastor Sam Rodriguez is president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, and here he talks to our Michelle Martin about how he once had the ear of President Obama and why now he advises President Trump.
Thanks, Christian. Pastor Sam, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
For those who may not remember, you've been with us before. You offered prayer at President Trump's inauguration in 2016. It was a sort of an important and powerful moment for you, but you had been connecting with and consulting with previous presidents. This is not the first sort of president that you have been close to, but this is the first time you were offered the opportunity to offer prayer at a presidential inauguration. Did you vote for President Trump?
Well, you know me well enough that I won't share who I voted for, but I worked with George W. Bush, advised President Bush. I worked with President Obama for 8 years. And now I'm advising President Trump. So I never share who I voted for, actually. It's just part of my covenant with God and my family.
It's been reported in the media, though, that you're campaigning for him. So is that not true?
Yeah, no, I'm campaigning for life, religious liberty, and biblical justice. That's what I'm campaigning for in 2020. To be very forthright, I was out there in 2008 for President Obama because I believed in his vision for America. And I do believe that right now, I'm an independent, but I do believe the Democratic Party has shifted so much to the left on these issues, on life, on religious liberty, that I am compelled because of my children and my children's children to advocate policies that line up with our biblical worldview.
So to that question, President Trump has ably demonstrated that he is against abortion. But with more than 200,000 people dead because of a COVID-19 crisis that the reporting indicates that he was not forthright about and did not take seriously at the outset, has he demonstrated that he's truly pro-life?
Now, this COVID-19 has impacted all of us. I was there in the beginning of certain conversations, working on the National Coronavirus Recovery Commission, giving advice as it pertains to churches and the response to COVID and even post facto. So I can tell you from the get-go, there was a commitment from this administration to deal with COVID in a very deliberate, intentional manner while simultaneously protecting our God-given rights. The tension constantly has been one issue. Do we give up our rights in the midst of a pandemic or any other circumstance that the government deems as an emergency? And I believe that tension is real, is legitimate. We should have a viable conversation, but I do not believe that President Trump has given up or forsaken or neglected the sanctity of life in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Why do you think this country has the worst, one of the worst death rates? It has certainly the worst overall number of deaths in the world, and it's got among the worst death rates for an affluent country. None of our peer economies, countries with comparable economies, a level of resources, a level of sort of access to technology, are suffering the way this country has. And I certainly don't think I need to tell you that Black and brown people are among right. the people who have been most devastated by this epidemic. Why is that?
Well, with great due deference, and I have an incredible amount of respect for you, of course, with great due deference, I would argue on the death rate. I do agree. The number of deaths is, of course, egregious. And any one life that is lost, of course, impacts all of us. But there's a difference between proportionality as it pertains to the population and the actual death rate in comparison to similar nations.
And the death rate, forgive me, Pastor, that is disingenuous. The death rate per thousand is worse in the United States than it is in any peer industrial country. We're not talking about India here. We're not talking about Brazil here. And we're not even talking about Mexico here. We're talking about countries like New Zealand. We're talking about Germany. We're talking about Australia. We're talking about countries with similar economies to ours. And the death rate in the United States is far worse. So tell me why you think that is. Critics of this administration say it's because this administration has failed to take the steps that would be necessary.
I would disagree with that. Two of those three nations are two of my favorite nations. I travel frequently every year prior to COVID, Australia and New Zealand. These are nations that are, of course, island nations, isolated. So they have the luxury of being able to shut down their borders like this immediately. And they did, both Australia and New Zealand. Yesterday, I spoke to one of the major pastoral leaders in Australia discussing the COVID reality by coincidence. Now, Germany, of course, we look at China travel as it pertains to those that already had from Wuhan, the initial virus. And there was a great amount of travel going around the world. And the president deliberately stated, we're gonna incorporate this travel ban, which I think had an incredible amount of foresight. He was critiqued initially as being xenophobic or racist and so forth. Again, he shut that down. If not for that decision right there, this 200,000 plus may be 2 million plus. So I do believe, I don't think everything has been pristine, by the way. I don't. I'll give you an example. Let me critique not just the administration for a second, but all of us. I remember having conversations with individuals stating from our government on both sides of the aisle, telling us that we shouldn't wear masks. That masks were basically a waste of time, that they would do absolutely nothing to deter the spread of the virus. And then we come to find out that it may be the primary deterrent mechanism. So across the board, and that came from both sides of the aisle, across the board, I don't think we have been perfect. At the same time, I think things could be enormously worse if not for the actions taken by this administration.
Now, if this administration is willing, forgive me, Pastor Sam, if this administration is willing to tell women they can't have an abortion, why isn't it willing to tell the rest of the country they have to wear a mask? This administration has steadfastly resisted guidance to the governors and ordering a national mask mandate. How is that pro-life?
Well, there's a couple of things here. One, this administration is addressing not just abortion. I think Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. Not that I agree with it. I believe every life is precious and has sanctity value that comes from God. With that being said, this administration is basically countering late-term abortion and even post-birth abortion, i.e. the governor of Virginia. So this is not Barack Obama's 2008 abortion policy. Hence, that's why you see now in a recent survey from last week, more Latino people self-identified as evangelicals. The numbers are up. They seem to be inclined to vote for President Trump because of that abortion sort of unbridled commitment, this obsession on the Democratic Party's part of late-term abortion and even post-birth abortion. I mean, who does that?
That is not the position of Joe Biden at all. It just isn't.
And that's it is the position of the Democratic Party. Absolutely. Every single time Joe Biden, who I think is a good person. Joe Biden, when he is asked about a late-term abortion, at least say late-term abortion, like President Obama.
Well, late-term abortion is not a medical term, so I don't know why you're insisting he use it. It's not a medical term. That is not a medical term.
Oh, you and I both know that's like straight away ignoring a response that would actually activate Latinos, more Latinos, to vote for Vice President Joe Biden. If the Democratic Party would go back to 2008, President Barack Obama's posture and stance and even presentation as it pertains to uniting the nation on so many issues, this election would be completely over, without a doubt.
Do you think President Trump's united the nation?
No, I don't think President Trump's united the nation, and I don't think President Trump has divided the nation. The question we have to ask ourselves is, why was he elected in the first place? Where did he come out of? Why did President Trump become president in 2016? What took place? And there were issues. I do believe that the Democratic Party swayed in the second term of a president who I absolutely love, President Obama, with one of the best first ladies ever, Michelle Obama, without a doubt. I do believe that at the end of his term, his second term, the Democratic Party was already swaying so radically to the left and neglected a populace in the electorate. Individuals who actually voted for him in 2008, President Obama, ended up flipping and voting for President Trump in 2016. And now the Democratic Party, in my humble opinion, has been hijacked. Socialism, I'm Latino, yo soy raza. Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, Nicaragua. How in the world can you tell this Latino who is pastoring and ministering to Hispanic immigrants, many of them undocumented, by the way, that I'm gonna support an ideology or a party that substantiates socialism? Are you kidding me? Again, where is the Democratic Party of President Barack Obama 2008? That's what I'm asking for.
So you've identified two issues that you say are critical to your vote, or at least your support. You're not telling us who you're going to vote for. You've identified abortion. You've identified socialism. And what's the third?
Religious liberty. Religious liberty. I live in California. I applauded Gavin Newsom. I'm independent. So I just want to call balls and strikes and be integral to me and my family and my faith. He was amazing in the beginning. Gavin Newsom was a rock star. He was trying
to dealing with COVID. You're talking about
dealing with COVID. He was trying to preserve the economy while saving lives. And he did it in such a practical, pragmatic way. Even in the back of my mind, I went, this is pretty amazing. He has the potential of running for president and actually maybe winning because he's very in the center right now. This is a centrist movement. All of a sudden, this is what happens when you listen to your advisors that have a myopic way of thinking. All of a sudden, casino liquor stores, cannabis stores, which is weed stores here in California, all of these things are open. Churches, you're shut down. Not just shut down, quote, here's a decree. You can't meet in your home for a prayer / fellowship gathering, Bible study. What? Are you kidding me? Even with masks, even with social distancing in my own home, you're telling me who I can meet with in my home?
To people of faith, people of particular faith practices, gathering is fundamental to faith. Gathering and prayer together, visiting together, is fundamental to some people's practice. So for some people, it is like eating. I mean, it is as essential as a form of sustenance as food. So granted that, but you're saying you don't see those as measures taken to preserve life.
Sure. There it is. I'm a practical person. I'm a Trekkie. So I'm not a fundamentalist. I'm a faith and science guy. Yes, if everything else would line up, if there would be no exception, you can't open up casinos and shut down churches. There are no conversations in casinos. None. People around don't gather in casinos. You can't discriminate. You can't say casinos and liquor stores are fine, churches are not. And not only that, look at the protests. And my family actually hosted a protest right after George Floyd's murder in my home state of Pennsylvania. We were there. So, many of my church members participated in peaceful protests without a doubt, because I'm committed to righteousness and justice. But I can't deny the fact that post facto, even in surroundings around my church, there were protesters that were not wearing masks. And don't give me the whole 93% were. I would love to know who statistically incorporated that study and how they did it. Show me the data, the methodology. No, a large number, some were wearing masks, a large number of individuals were not. You can't permit protests where people are gathering, speaking, shouting, and then say, churches, you can't gather. That's religious liberty. I believe in religious liberty. I think religious liberty is the firewall against secular totalitarianism. And we have seen during COVID, not just in California, but in Michigan and other states, coincidentally driven by Democratic governors, who are infringing upon my God-given right to gather, which I do believe is essential, and worship. So I do. It's life. Not this idea of stopping a woman from having an abortion. That phraseology doesn't line up. I have feminist daughters, Christian feminist daughters.
Okay, so let's go back to that as a matter of policy. So presumably one of the policies that you agree with is appointing judges who will overturn Roe v. Wade, at least with the intention of overturning Roe v. Wade. What is your vision of the way America will be if that occurs?
Yeah. My inclination is to see judges appointed to the highest judicial branch or the highest judicial appointment in the land that look at the Constitution not as a fluid document, but look at the Constitution and adhere to and respect the original intent of that document. Some have argued it's a sacred document. I'm not committed to idolatry, but it is an important document indeed. So I'm committed to that. I think Amy Cohen is amazing in her commitment to preserving, to applying the letter of the law rather than reading into it.
This idea of
legislators from the bench.
The president's made it clear. Amy Coney Barrett has her entire sort of area of research is focused on overturning precedent. So I don't see how you can say that the goal is to overturn Roe. It clearly is to overturn Roe v. Wade. The president said that's his whole framework in selecting judges are people who are reliable conservatives. So I'm just asking you the question: What is the vision of America after Roe is overturned?
My vision of America would be to see every single life protected in and out of the womb. As it pertains to overturning Roe v. Wade, every single person who has come up to the bench, the Senate, has argued that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. So even though I am staunchly pro-life from the womb to the tomb, from the moment of conception, I do believe that we can find a practical area where at least we can all come in agreement that late-term abortion is unacceptable, unless it's a medical emergency and by medical, the death of the mother, right?
So should women be prosecuted for having an abortion?
No, of course not. Of course not. Of course not. And it's not even about women being prosecuted. No, no, no. No, this idea that it's anti-women is a misnomer. Quite the opposite. That's why we're seeing millennials, even millennial young ladies, who are lining up with an ethos that is more pro-life. And that's Pew Research, not me.
So Pastor Sim, obviously there's kind of a lot to talk about here. The president remarked about contracting COVID. He said, I think this was a blessing from God that I caught it. How do you respond to that?
That's a Trumpism. Again, that's a Trumpism. That's President Trump being President Trump with his commentary, descriptors, nomenclatures, and vocabulary and language that's germane to the reality of Donald J. Trump. I personally don't see COVID as a gift from God. I understand what he's saying, that it enables him to understand the reality. And if it is a gift to understand the suffering of your fellow man, I don't know if it's a gift. It may be a blessed burden would be the theological phrase. That may be a better application. But
do you think he understands the suffering of his fellow human beings?
I actually do. I mean, I know the man on a personal level. I've seen him become emotional. I've seen him express great concern, even angst and consternation regarding some of the social melees taking place in America. So I do. I think it's hard to understand President Trump unless you've met him and know him personally. I wouldn't support anyone. The depiction of President Trump in the media would be someone I would never support in the media, in the mass media. But I know this man personally. He is a human being. He is emerging in his faith. He loves his family. He loves America. He wants people. He really is committed to one thing. Instead of seeing Americans survive, he wants them to thrive. And that's what he's fighting for. I don't think he does it perfectly. No president does it perfectly. But I do think his heart is in the right place.
Pastor Sam Rodriguez, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
And just a reminder that we in the media are committed to looking at the truth and bringing the facts no matter where the story is. And finally, the other race of our lives, and that is the one to save our natural habitat. The Earthshot Prize, named after President Kennedy's moonshot program, is the brainchild of Britain's Prince William. He announced today that it will award 5 £1 million prizes each year over the next 10 years. That's about $1.2 million to anyone coming up with solutions to catastrophic climate change. William was inspired by the world's most important naturalist, Sir David Attenborough. His own climate manifesto, A Life on Our Planet, is airing now, and he'll be one of the judges of this new prize.
The thing that strikes me is that time is short. I am well aware, as in my travels in the environment, so I'm seeing problems that are right now, and they are building. I mean, we really have to be getting onto it as fast as we can, do we not?
This next 10 years is the critical decade of change. We have to have made huge strides in repairing the planet before 2030, otherwise irreversible change, and that tipping point has happened. And so it really is, you know, time is of the essence, which is why we believe this very ambitious global prize is the only way forward.
Now, how many remember that William's father, Prince Charles, was urging climate and environmental care way before it was cool? Back then, people thought he was dotty. Those are his words. Not anymore. And tune in to tomorrow's program for our interview with former CIA chief John Brennan. He knows more about threats facing America than almost anybody, and he's deeply worried about this election, and he'll tell us exactly why. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.